WRT 89.9 FM, Madison, listener-sponsored community radio. Please stay tuned for Her Turn, coming up next.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
Good morning and welcome to Her Turn, a program of news and information by and about women. I'm Madison Delier.
And I'm Morgan Davies. On today's program, under threats to cut funding, feminists will persist. We'll have a story from right here in our backyard about how important it is to come together in our community.
The Trump administration's 90% cuts to foreign aid have done immense harm to vulnerable people across the world.
And reclaiming our American history through poetry in motion. That's the aim of Renee Scott Best and her book about Black inventors.
So stay tuned for all of this and more on the Sunday, April 13th, 2025 edition of Her Turn. This week, Wisconsin Attorney General She's calling on the state to pick up the slack for those who are survivors of domestic abuse. He held a news conference this week surrounded by anti-violence advocates to address the dire situation when it comes to funding. The federal government, through the Office of Violence Against Women, used to be a major funder for domestic abuse programs, but now is no longer offering grant opportunities. Programs around the state are struggling to keep their doors open. The Hmong American Women's Association in Milwaukee, which offers resources to Southeast Asian survivors in their own language, was at the press conference. It has had to cut half of its employees, down from 10 to 5. The Resource Center, which helps women fleeing traffickers, has had its funding cut by almost two-thirds. Attorney General urged state lawmakers to approve $68 million over the next 2 years for crime victim services. It is not yet clear how the Republican state legislature will respond. Governor Tony Evers' budget has included $66 million in crime victim services.
Maya Angelou's book, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, is no longer available at the Naval Academy Library, but Mein Kampf is. Last week, we found out that in accordance with DEI orders from the Trump administration and on orders from Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, the Academy was purging its library holdings. This week, we found out which books are out. Among the almost 400 books that have been removed, How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram X. Kendi tops the list. Stacey Abrams' book, Our Time Is Now, Power, Purpose, and the Fight for a Fair America is gone. As are books about the Holocaust, women in Afghanistan, Chinese Americans, and anything with gender in the title. UW-Madison has a claim to fame on the list. History professor Linda Gordon's book, The Second Coming of the KKK, The Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s, and the American Political Tradition has also been removed.
Teenagers at West High School are still using the word equality. This past week, the school hosted its second annual Equality Symposium. At the full-day event last Wednesday, students could attend about 70 different sessions, ranging from life guidance to mental health to political printmaking. Workshops were hosted by a number of community members. Wisconsin State Representative Renuk Medev, whose districts include West High, was there to speak about what it's like to be an elected official. She says that it's important for young people to see themselves in leadership roles. She's also seen an increase in people being engaged and wants to inspire more kids to become politically active.
This week, over 300 people from across the Midwest and elsewhere came together for the 49th Women and Gender Studies Conference held at the Pyle Center. It was called Embodying Feminism, Calling In, Calling Out, Calling to Action. Topics included disability, fat phobia, digital spaces, bodily autonomy, transnational feminism, the use of art in our movements, and all of their intersectionality. Her Turn reporter Arlene Zaucha was there and asked some of the participants why they thought such a conference was still vital, especially at a time when so many feminist works are under threat. Here's what some of them had to say.
My name is Maddie Ballantyne. I am from Fairfield, Connecticut, and I'm a current student at UW-Madison.
And why are you here today? Why is a conference like this important?
Well, I'm here with Wheelhouse Studios today, and well, for us, why it's important is because, I mean, we want to make art accessible for everyone, and that includes especially like marginalized groups and especially people who just don't have access to like art, because it's just it's very expensive. Art is a great way to build community, especially in a place like this where, like, you know, you're all here for like the same reason. You just want to build community. You want to help other people. You want to help women. We just wanted to, I don't know, bring awareness and like make art accessible for everyone here and just like let people know that.
The state legislature is going to be cracking down on things that say DEI or do you have any feeling about that?
I think it's extremely disappointing, to be honest. I mean, the DEI programs here at UW-Madison are part of the reason why I came here in the first place. And so just seeing them cut down is just really disappointing. And I feel like we have to work twice as hard now in order to, one, get them back, and two, do more for the community. So it's just, I feel like, it feels like we're taking a step back instead of a step forward. But I feel like with more community effort, then maybe, hopefully, we'll be able to get them back and do more for community.
Hi, my name is Pa Hua Her, and I'm from Minnesota, the Twin Cities. I'm an artist. I'm looking forward to be in conversation with the artists here, and I think that this is a place to come and to learn about each other's work and to have community, and conferences like this are really, really important.
Hi, I'm Dr. Kintara Suffrat, and I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm here today to serve on the artist panel, and I think conferences like this are so important during the time that we're living in because they allow us an opportunity to come together, learn from each other, strategize, and maybe find some joy that'll fuel our tanks and get us revved up for the work that needs to happen.
My name's Gabby. I'm from Winona State University. I'm on my advisor's research team. I major in psychology. We focus a lot on gender and how different like stigmas and different like genders impact like treatment for like mental health and all that kind of stuff. And so we thought this would be a really good conference to come to and learn about like different like stereotypes, stigmas, and all that stuff.
There's such an attack right now on things like this.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
It makes me really sad, and I want more people to be aware of like how dangerous it can be. So by educating myself, I can help educate others and hopefully spread awareness.
My name is Molly Marston. I'm from Winona, Minnesota. And what brought me here today was we presented at a conference regarding benevolent sexism within women with an older generational sample and a younger generational sample and how it affected their self-esteem, empowerment, and career aspirations. And that was the primary drive to be here today, but also learn other parts of research and aspects within the community.
And why do you think this kind of conference is important?
I think it's really important because, I mean, I've seen it firsthand that it's a lot of things brought up that I have never considered. And even we went to another Winona, Minnesota conference, and they were bringing things up about our community at our university that I had never even considered or known about. And I've been there for multiple years now. So just kind of being educated within what's happening right in our backyard.
I'm Candace Salyers. I live in occupied Choctaw territory that's called Southern Mississippi at this point, and I'm a professor at the University of Southern Mississippi and also the director of our Women's Center. There are so many reasons why this kind of conference is important. I just have been so impressed and moved by the intersections, especially of WGS and disability studies at this particular conference, which I think is inherent but is not always made explicit. And so I just really have been so grateful to see the outstanding work that people are doing in this region, because I haven't been here in 20 years. I've lived all over the country, but I used to live in Madison, and it's been such an incredible opportunity to come back and see the absolutely amazing work people are doing here. Obviously, there are a lot of problems in Mississippi and all over the country, all over the world. And in fact, I was really disappointed the other day when I mentioned where I was from, and another participant in the conference said, "Oh, of course you're facing that. You live in Mississippi." And I wanted to mention, and of course I did before I presented, because I was talking about Mississippi, you know, that I think it's important that we all hold also the beauties of the places that we're living in, alongside all of the problems. There's a rich legacy of activist work that has happened in Mississippi and continues to happen in Mississippi, and that as much as, you know, we think about the issues that have stemmed from Mississippi that have then impacted the entire nation, there's also activism from Mississippi that has positively impacted the nation and the world too.
I'm Judith, and I'm from Germany. I'm doing research in FET studies, and I saw that there was a FET studies track, and that's why I came. And there aren't that many FET studies researchers, and it's always good to have an opportunity to connect and also listen to some other very exciting research.
My name is Mai Zhang. I grew up in Fresno, California, and I came here 3 years ago for a master's and PhD social work, social welfare program. I'm in my third year. As a graduate student, it's always really hard to try to get funding to travel to conferences. And so because I am a UW-Madison student, and there was a grant, thankfully, to allow UW system students to attend this conference for free, I just feel very included. And I think I learned a lot through kind of like observing what people are presenting on. And I think it's helpful for my own learning of like whenever I'm presenting or what I might want to do at conferences as a graduate student. And so I think I just felt like I really needed to take advantage of this opportunity. Yeah, you know, I'm just really happy that I think I have a good support system, and people like in this space have been very supportive around just being together. I think as a student, I'm more like avoidant of like all the things that are happening because I'm just trying to get through the semester. But I think being in spaces like this and hearing people talk, I know that, oh, people have my back and people are looking to fight for funding or like do their best to get funding for graduate students so that we can excel and finish our programs. And so that's another reason why I feel like a space like this is so needed and important. And I think just being here is very refreshing. Like I feel very taken care of at this conference, and so I just felt like it's a very well-paced conference and have been very beneficial and makes me feel very safe to be here. Yeah.
That was from some of the participants at this week's Women and Gender Studies Conference. We hope to bring you more from the conference on future shows.
Ursula Nuzan-Lata is the Legislative Director for Peacebuilding at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. She lobbies Congress to establish peacebuilding as a central goal of U.S. foreign policy. FCNL and Friends of Earth recently convened at the Interfaith Working Group on Foreign Assistance for a series of meetings with leaders in Washington, D.C. in response to the Trump administration's recent 90% cuts to foreign aid, which she says have done immense harm to vulnerable people across the world.
So at the start of this new administration, several executive orders and memos were released in quick succession that initially froze and required a stop work order on nearly all U.S. foreign assistance around the world. That has then led to terminations of 90% of those programs. So what was originally meant to be a pause has become near permanent. What that looks like is about 5,500 grants out of 6,000 grants and contracts made by USAID, amounting to about $54 billion. Additionally, 4,000 of the 9,000 grants and contracts that the State Department ran have also been eliminated, and amounting to another $4.5 billion. So we're looking at about $60 billion in cuts, which is still less than 1% of the federal budget. But those $60 billion allowed the U.S. to be the world's largest provider of food, medical, and humanitarian aid globally. It supported efforts like demining in countries across Southeast Asia. It supported peace-building efforts across Africa and Central America to help reduce violence. It really provided critical, both immediate needs to millions of people around the world who are suffering from AIDS, tuberculosis, and other infectious diseases, food assistance to starving children, and also looked at long-term drivers of instability and supporting economic growth around the world. Peace building and conflict prevention is one of the most cost-effective things the U.S. government can invest in. A recent report last December by the International Monetary Fund found that for every dollar we invest in preventing violent conflict, saves $26 to $103 in the cost of conflict. So that's both the cost of military action, but also rebuilding lost economic output, humanitarian assistance required by the conflict.
In addition to citing the incredible cost-effectiveness of peace efforts, she also noted that the previous Trump administration supported it, including signing the Women's Peace and Security Act of 2017.
Legislation, which looks at how do we prevent violence against women and girls, protect women and girls in conflict situations from the horrors of conflict-related sexual violence, displacement, and harm, as well as really looking at how can women be active participants, how can we engage women in building peace, in supporting peace processes, in being at the table as we look toward what a sustainable peace post-conflict looks like. Most of the peacebuilding work is less than $150 million combined. It's a really small pot of money, but it goes so far in preventing violence, preventing human suffering, and increasing stability around the world. In the first Trump administration, while there were proposed cuts in the presidential budget request, he did look at making a 30% cut to foreign assistance. He did want to make cuts previously. He also did sign into law several really important pieces of legislation that support this work that have now been really demolished by the actions of the foreign aid cuts at the start of this new Trump administration.
She also noted that peace builders and the human rights defenders who saw the U.S. as a partner for their futures have also been abandoned essentially overnight.
Basically, within a matter of hours, USAID staff were told, "We're stopping all funding. Reach out to all of your grantees and tell them to immediately stop work." And then at the same time, they were laying off USAID staff. So organizations received information saying you have to stop all work associated with your grants with the United States. And at the same time, the person that you've built a relationship with at USAID has now been laid off. So when you reach back out for clarification, there was no one there to answer your questions. For millions of human rights activists around the world, they get a message saying stop work and then no further contact. So there's been a lot of disruption, a lot of miscommunication globally as people sort of receive these memos and then don't know what to do next. and then later received terminations. One of our partners who participated in the Interfaith Working Group on Foreign Assistance, they received PEPFAR money. PEPFAR is one of the world's leading initiatives to end the scourge of HIV and AIDS. It's had a huge global impact. They were receiving funding under this with a clinic in Kenya. The clinic then received instructions to say, okay, you can start some work, but we need you to commit to not do any DEI work. So the US-based staff member had to explain to the Kenyan clinicians, this is what DEI is. This is what these principles are that we are now being told not to use, even though that many times is the best clinical practice to seek out those most at risk for HIV transmission, for AIDS. There's also just a lot of misunderstanding around what some of these things are and how it impacts the work globally.
That was Ursula Canusa-Lata of the Friends Committee on National Legislation. She was interviewed by Jan Minasaki on WRT's Wednesday 8 o'clock buzz. Her full interview about the fallout of U.S. foreign aid cuts on worldwide peacebuilding efforts can be heard on the audio archive at WRT.org.
On a nationwide scale, American history is being rewritten by the current administration. Government websites are being purged of content about the accomplishments of women and people of color. But Her Turn reporter, Arlene Zoucha, talked to a woman who is honoring the contributions of those who have improved our lives with their creative endeavors, Black inventors.
My name is Renee Scott Best, and I'm a retired teacher of 38 years. I'm also an author of a book called Crazy in the Classroom. I'm a screenwriter, and my latest endeavor is writing poetry. So I wrote a book called Black Inventors, Poetry in Motion.
And why exactly that topic?
Well, I picked this topic in light of the present book banning in Florida and what's going on across the country. And I wanted to create poetry in a meaningful way with a historical book featuring 50 African-American inventors and over a dozen of these being women. But I think the most important reason why I wrote this book is to dispel the horrible stereotypes and biases that falsely represent African-American men and women as inferior and less intelligent. And so once we learn about these inventions by African-Americans, we have to acknowledge African-American women and men's creativity, innovation, ingenuity, and intellectual ability to think critically and problem solve. Also, the reason I think this is important and why I was so spurred and energetic about writing this, it builds African-American knowledge about themselves, their accomplishments in science, medicine, and technology, and building our self-esteem in the environment that we live in called the United States. And secondly, it's important that white America recognize that without African-American inventions, life would be very difficult. Without the toilet, refrigerator, oven range, long-distance flying airplanes, pacemaker, central air and heating systems, imaging x-rays, food preservatives, and that's just to name a few of the 50 that I wrote about. African-American women have invented things like closed-circuit television, security system, surgical instruments, cure for leprosy, the simple ironing board, solar cells, portable facts. All these things were created by African-American women. So I'm so happy to be able to celebrate them.
Thank you so much. That's quite a list. And you kind of already answered who you hope to reach with this book.
Well, I'm really happy because I have reached over probably maybe 150 to 200 people with radio interviews and seminars. And what I like the best is that the majority of these people that I have personally presented were Caucasian people. So I was so excited to teach Caucasian people who are not knowledgeable about inventions, especially those created by African Americans. Because I'm a teacher, I created this whole interactive curriculum. I couldn't help it. And so I go out and I'll do this in a classroom setting. And I did it at a white church. And afterwards, one of the ladies came up and she had tears in her eyes. And I was like, oh, my God, why are you crying? You know, what did I do? What did I say? And she told me, she says, I'm crying because white people don't know how intelligent and innovative African Americans are, you know, and well, we're brought here as enslaved people. And I think for that reason, people have thought we were less intelligent and inferior, and it's just not true.
Some of us have concerns about this particular time in history. You mentioned the book banning that's going on in Florida. It's happening here in Wisconsin as well. It seems like our history is being rewritten or ignored. Do you have any concerns about that?
Oh, big concerns. I think I saw you at one of the ASALA meetings, African American Study of Life and History. Organizations like that are so important, and they do have the Freedom School in the summertime, which I do teach. So it's almost like we can't learn it in the public schools. So now we have to teach our own children about their history because it's being banned. Why? I don't understand. First of all, it's not Black history. This is American history, and we are part of that history. We are part of the American story.
And you specifically wrote this in poetry. Why poetry?
Because I love the creativity of it. I've been writing it since I was a little girl. It was one of the things I wanted to be when I grew up, a poet. My mother wrote poetry. My great aunt wrote beautiful poetry. So that inspired me. It's fun. It's challenging. What I do is I write the first line and I take the last word and I make a list of rhyming words. And then I'll write that second sentence and choose one of those writing words. So it was kind of like a puzzle for me, very challenging, got my brain working pretty good. So poetry is kind of hard because you have to have a rhythm. You have to have a large vocabulary to be able to rhyme, especially some of the words that I use.
Are you able to grace us with maybe a couple excerpts from your book?
Yeah, I chose four poems about African-American women that I think you're going to enjoy. The first one is Katherine G. Johnson. My name is Katherine G. Johnson, and we're going to have some fun. Being one of America's greatest mathematicians is how I begun. I was born in West Virginia in 1918. I lived to be 102 years old, it seems. I graduated college at 18, making me a child prodigy. I became a NASA scientist for all to see. I worked for NASA for 35 years. I experienced discrimination to the point of tears. I discovered the calculations for returning spaceships in flight. I won many prestigious awards, making my life better and bright.
That's great.
Okay, Dr. Patricia Bass, the laser FICO probe. My name is Dr. Patricia Bath, and we're going to have some fun. Finding an effective treatment for cataracts is how I begun. My African-American patients suffered blindness at a much higher rate, while my white patients had preventative treatment before it was too late. I set up eye care clinics in many underserved communities. Now they are worldwide, helping with immunities. My laser FICO probe made treatment of cataracts less painful and more concise. My invention helps to recover eyesight so precise.
I think that's a name that a lot of us don't know.
Oh my goodness, I went to the eye doctor. He said I had cataracts. Don't worry. They can give me surgery. So I said, are you going to use the laser FICO probe? And he said, yes. How did you know? I said, well, a Black woman, Dr. Patricia Bath, invented that. He was like, no kidding. I was like, no, not kidding. Here's one, Marie Van Britten Brown. She invented the closed circuit television security system. My name is Maria Van Britten Brown, and we're going to have some fun. Creating the closed circuit television is how I begun. Our neighborhood was rough with a lot of home robberies. With Neighborhood Watch, we created camaraderie. That was not enough. Police response was very slow. So I invented the video security system and gave it a go. cameras, monitors, and microphones galore, remote control locks, and four peek holes in the door. So when you're relaxing all alone, use my video security system in your home. I have one last one for you. This is Shirley Jackson, Dr. Shirley Jackson. She invented caller ID, call waiting, portable fax, solar cells, and touch tone dialing. Now, some of that is antiquated right now, but we still use caller ID, of course. My name is Shirley Jackson, and we're going to have some fun. Providing breakthrough scientific research is how I began. I am the first African American to earn a PhD from the various prestigious University of MIT, a theoretical physicist with many scientific advancements. The technology behind caller ID and call waiting were my enhancements, portable fax, touch tone dialing, solar cells, to name a few. Fiber optic cables were based on my research, too. Thank you for letting me read a couple of those.
Well, thank you so much. Was there anything else you wanted to add today?
What I do want to add is, in the back of my poetry book, I have all the patents listed for these inventions, because a lot of skeptical people will say, oh, you didn't, Black people didn't invent that. What are you talking about? And so I was aware of that when I put this book together. And I have a patent reference page. And if you know anything about patents, that means that you're the one that invented it and you submit it to the Department of Patents and you actually get a number. So this is kind of like my proof to those naysayers who say, oh no, you know, Thomas Elkins didn't invent the oven range, but I have the patent number right there.
Renee Scott Best is the author of Black Poetry in Motion, a book about Black inventors. The book can be ordered at any of your local independent bookstores and is also available on Amazon.
Sources used in assembling today's program include WRT's Wednesday 8 o'clock Buzz, Madison 360, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the New York Times, and the Baltimore Banner.
Today's edition of Her Turn was produced by Arlene Zoucha with assistance from Joanne Powers, who was also our on-air engineer. Other contributors include Morgan Davies, Madison Delier, and Eliza Howard. Now stay tuned for 2.5 hours of Women in Music on Her Infinite Variety with host